You're listening to a 3CR podcast created in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
Green Left Weekly Radio.
There's one newspaper that is independent of powerful capitalist interests, and that is Green Left Weekly.
It's the people's voice, committed to human and civil rights, ecological sustainability, democracy and equality. It presents ideas that the mainstream media won't.
Green Left is a leading source of local, national and international news with analysis, discussion and debate to strengthen the anti-capitalist movement.
It helps expose the lies of the capitalist press and puts the voices of the marginalised and the oppressed at the centre of fighting for a better world and helps us understand the political developments unfolding around us.
Good morning, listeners. You are listening to Green Left Radio on 3CR or 855 AM on your dial, or maybe you are also streaming live from the 3CR website or listening back to a podcast. Wherever you are, thanks for joining us today. And you're joined today by myself, Jacob Antwerfer, and my co-presenter,
Zane Alcorn. How you going?
Hey, good morning, Zane. It's great to have you as a co-presenter today.
Good to be back on the horse.
Yeah. To kind of start, before we kind of announce what we have coming up on the program, I'd like to acknowledge that 3CR and Green Left recognise that this show is being broadcasted from the land of the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung, the Wurundjeri rightful sovereign owners, storytellers and caretakers of the land. Australia was founded on the attempted genocide and dispossession of the First People, and we recognise that this attempted genocide is ongoing. As socialists, we pledge to actively support decolonisation. We stand with all the First Peoples in their struggle for justice and rights to their land. Now, just to kind of announce what we have coming up. So we have two interviews lined up. We have one with Brooke Forbes. Forbes. She has sort of recently published a book titled Survival is an Instinct. Zane has a bit more information about that. I mean, do you want to sort of describe what the kind of book is, introduce our listeners about what it's about?
Yeah, so I'll give a content warning now and another content warning before we speak to Brooke. Her interview and her book does regard a workplace sexual assault, which in her case triggered the trauma of that triggered a severe mental health issue, psychosis. And so her book looks at that and kind of in a very interesting, creative way, her book looks at how the psychosis was, I guess, a survival mechanism. And was a way that she subconsciously tried to escape from the trauma and give herself time to process it. So since that assault, Brooke has ended up studying law and getting a law degree and is now working out in Mbantua, Alice Springs in the Community Legal Service. And yeah, she's written a book. She's also got a short fiction competition that's happening as part of the launch of that book. And yeah, be really good to speak to her this morning.
Yeah, so that sounds like a very good interview that we have lined up. And at 8:10 a.m., we're going to be speaking to the Australian Services Union Secretary, Tash Wark, and this is going to be about the in-council workers' strike that is actually currently going on right now. And in fact, there is a big dispute that a lot of the councils are having with council workers, with the management of a lot of the councils, where they're essentially fighting for, you know, serious kind of wage increases in line with the impacts of inflation. And in fact, one thing that's sort of just been announced by the government is The state government is sort of announcing like a big pay increase for all kind of public elected kind of officials, including local councillors, mayors, but also even parliamentarians. So the state government has announced that, but then they haven't really made. But meanwhile, the local councils are getting away. We're essentially not coming to the table with a serious pay increase for the council workers. So there is actually going to be a big strike happening on May the 5th. The council workers are going to be taking industrial action for 24 hours, and there'll be a rally at 10 a.m. On Tuesday, 5th of May. And I think, it'll be very important. I think this will be a very important kind of rally. And I think one of the important things that the ASU would really appreciate is they definitely appreciate all the support they can get from the community, so and other trade unions coming along to the strike. So the interview that we were doing with Tash Wark will kind of focus on that.
Yeah, nice. Yeah, I'm up in Hume. There's been disruptions to our rubbish bins being collected because the council workers are on strike, and that's inconvenient. But that's, you know, I 100% support those workers. ASU members. One of the more disturbing things that I've seen just in the last couple of days is that there's been scab contractors brought in by Hume Council, by Marybeck, I've heard as well, to try and get around the strike, which is just disgraceful. And Hume is a very, Hume and Marybeck, but particularly Hume, it's a very working class area. Local government is meant to be the layer of government that's closest to the people, and for them to be bringing in scabs is just disgraceful.
Yep, absolutely. So yeah, all the solidarity to the council workers, and yeah, I'm looking forward to interviewing Tash Wark later on in the program. Now let's go into some headline news discussion. So we have at least like the next 30 to 40 minutes, and we'll also play a number of songs as well throughout the program. The first kind of news story I want to discuss in terms of headline news is the whole issue of the National Disability Insurance Scheme. That's the correct term, isn't it? For the NDIS. Now, the Labor government has made a very major announcement that they're going to basically be very much re-ramping. They've announced it as revamping, but essentially more than 160 people are potentially going to be kicked off the NDIS, as essentially the Labor government is going to be overhauling the eligibility of the program. Now, this is very outrageous, and this is obviously caused the error of many people, many disability groups, many people with disabilities. You know, there's also the certain kind of uncertainty about it all, because on one hand, the Labor government is saying that, okay, yes, people are going to be kicked off the program, but no, we're also going to be negotiating with state governments to make sure there's state support systems in place. So there's a lot of lack of detail on what is actually happening with the NDIS. Now, of course, the Labor government has obviously they have pointed to obviously there's certain issues with the NDIS in terms of the actions of kind of private operators, etc. So they have made promises around overhauling it, but the whole framework from the Labor government is not necessarily about. They're not necessarily giving the message that, you know, the NDIS, we're here to overhaul it, to make it better for people with disabilities. No, the actual line that they're putting is, we need to save money. The program is completely unsustainable in terms of the millions of dollars that we're spending on it. Also, it's outrageous. We only designed the program for X number of people who have disabilities, but no, there's actually more people who have disabilities than we thought, which is actually, I mean, that kind of says everything, because really, from the perspective of a government and how they treat people with disabilities, often capitalist governments will often only accept the existence of severe physical kind of disabilities as a precondition for defining someone as disabilities, but of course there's many disabilities that people have, especially mental disabilities, which are often kind of invisibilized or not treated as as real kind of disabilities that are needed, that are deserving of kind of support, etc.
And which can deteriorate if they're not treated. And so there's actually a false economy here where by saving money, by withdrawing these supports, you're actually creating a trap where people are less able to be, integrated and functional and you know, more sort of able to participate in society fully and participate in the economy. So I think that's even that, even this cruel sort of economistic argument that views everything in terms of dollar signs, even that argument I don't think stacks up.
Yeah, absolutely. And also, I think there's also a few other things. I mean, people who... some commentators from the left have also raised a number of other issues as well. And that is obviously, there is obviously this whole bureaucratization of the NDIS, and there's a lot of poor practices with the private operators who operate within the NDIS. But one of the things as well about the NDIS, and this was sort of pointed out by a number of people, is that, like, some of the things with the NDIS that a lot of people with disabilities rely on support for in terms of the NDIS, some of the things that people with disabilities have to use the NDIS for, like, for example, someone who there are people with disabilities who have to use the NDIS to be able to provide, like, access to things like taxis, to be able to get, to be able to transport everywhere, etc. Now, one of the things as well with that as well is, if the Labor government was so concerned about the fact that the NDIS is being costed for services like that, well, where is their effort in terms of making sure that public transport and other infrastructure is accessible by people with disabilities? Like, one of the big issues for people with disabilities is most of society is not actually designed for people with disabilities. It's designed for able-bodied people, and in fact, the government puts the idea of things like disability access, etc., are since treated like an afterthought by most state governments around the world. So I think that is one issue that is sort of obviously not being explored. And I also would have to say, one comment I have an issue with Albanese saying. He made this kind of comment along the lines of, there's people out there who are just literally, like, referring to NDIS workers, there's just NDIS workers who are just sitting on their phones most of the day while taking care of someone with disability. And it's like, well, okay, at the end of the day, you point to those examples of individual workers as a justification for why we get cuts. Well, actually, at the end of the day, I mean, there are workers who are that you could go into any workplace in the industry and you could find some lazy workers, even in childcare.
You could go into the federal parliament on any given day and you could see a whole lot of politicians sitting on their phone in the parliament.
Yeah, absolutely. Doing absolutely probably no work whatsoever.
And getting paid a couple hundred grand.
A year. So, yeah, they are Labor politicians. I know for a fact they are Labor politicians that that constituents can never have meetings with, that never respond to emails, etc. So, for Albanese to kind of make this Abbott sort of claim is ridiculous.
Well, another one that I saw was, this person had to pay $50 to have a shower. Well, okay, if you're a disability support worker, first of all, if this was all done as a public service, it would be a hell of a lot cheaper. And we've seen this with the attacks on the CFMEU going, there's these big cost blowouts and this bullshit number of $15 billion has been thrown around that's gone missing. When you do public-private partnerships, and that's what the NDIS is, it's a voucher scheme that allows private operators and the market to provide all the services. When you do it that way, the worker might get paid $30 or $40 an hour or whatever, but the company that's running that NDIS enterprise is charging probably twice that. They're probably charging $80 an hour to send out a worker who's getting paid $30 or $40 an hour to provide this service. That's inherently highly inefficient. And the other thing to say about this is if you get a plumber to come to your house, they've usually got a minimum call-out fee of like 3 or 4 hours. And the reason for that is if you get booked for a little plumbing job, then that's going to wipe out half of your day. You can't do other jobs for that day. And it's going to be the same if you're providing disability support services. If you're coming out to do a small amount of work, it may be possible for you to line up a bunch of those jobs in a row to stay, you know, to get a whole bunch of work done throughout the day, but it isn't necessarily possible to do that. So the nature of getting called out to little jobs, particularly if it's being run by small enterprises that don't necessarily have a whole run of work booked in, you kind of have to charge more for these little call-outs to cover the fact that there's going to be a lot of downtime where you're not getting paid anything between these little call-outs. So this is another question that emerges from this. The NDIS would be a hell of a lot more efficient if it was a publicly owned, a publicly run service, a comprehensive publicly run disability support service where you had a unionised full-time workforce, largely, providing those services and being sent out in a sort of much more centralised and efficient way, rather than this scattergun approach of handing out vouchers to all of these small operators, a lot of whom are not even registered. It's inherently kind of chaotic and inefficient. But yeah, it should not be up to recipients of NDIS services to bear the blame of cost shifting. And then, of course, the other obvious point that's being made is there's infinite money for nuclear submarines and war, which can be magicked out of the air. But then when it comes to disability service recipients, suddenly Grandpa Elbow breaks out the abacus. Or, oh, I don't know if we can afford this. And that double standard is disgraceful. And then we've also seen this week, and we might talk a bit more about this, Elbow coming out saying, oh, we can't have a tax on gas exports like independent Senator David Pocock and other community organisations and the Greens have been calling for. We don't want to do that. So again, there's a shortfall in revenue because multinational corporations are getting gas virtually for free and exporting it and making huge profits at the moment. And then meanwhile, there's this thing about, oh yeah, we're going to have to make cuts because we can't afford it. And then another issue that emerges on the NDIS front is Mark Butler was the Disability Services Minister was speaking yesterday saying, well, we're not going to kick people off the NDIS until there are alternative state-based services for people with lower needs. And then the state governments are pushing back and saying, well, who's funding that? So there's these cuts to reportedly save money. There's this claim that no one's going to be kicked off the NDIS. And those two things don't stack up either. State governments, more or less, particularly around health, they get their money from the federal government to run services, hospitals, schools, etc. The federal government collects taxes and then it sends it out to the states, and the states administer things like healthcare and schools. So if there's going to be a state-based program for lower needs NDIS recipients, they're going to need money from the federal government to pay for these additional extra services. So how are you saving money by devolving this to the states? And if you're not going to give them their money, the money to provide those services, then obviously people will be kicked off the NDIS. So you can't have it both ways. You can't say, oh, no one's going to be kicked off the NDIS. We're just going to devolve it to the states. And then on the other hand say, and we're doing this to save money. You can't do both of those things. If you're saving money, people are going to be kicked off the NDIS. Full stop, end of story. And that is unacceptable in my opinion.
Yeah. Also, I think that one of the other elements as well is, you know, I think you kind of pointed this out kind of before, but I mean, because I think, you know, the perspective that I think for you know, socialists, the left and, you know, the Green Left radio program is, you know, we're not really that concerned with this question of, you know, the state states and the federal government balancing the budget, because, you know, this whole question about balancing the budget is really a political question at the end of the day. Mm. The government is as Zane, you pointed out, you know, the government makes its priorities quite clear when it's spending. It has lots of money to give in terms of subsidies to fossil fuel companies. It has lots of money to give in terms of military spending. Has lots of money to give in terms of law and order, which disproportionately does impact on people with disabilities too. Mm. And so, you know, there's all these things that the government has lots of money for, but of course, essential services like disability support is seen as like, yeah, we have to look into balancing the budget. But also, I think one other element as well of how capitalist governments are so inefficient with their allocation of resources is one of the big challenges, and this is for people who are on the NDIS. Who are really shook by this announcement is they are worried about, okay, am I still going to get the care and the services that I need?
And some people be kicked off, and then those remaining on the NDIS are going to have their services stripped back.
There's sort of uncertainty there. Mm. But of course, one of the things about the nature of capitalist governments is they basically hire all these bureaucrats bureaucrats to even assess people's eligibility. So there's all these resources just being invested in some bureaucrat who has no lived experience of disability determining whether a person with disability actually deserves the support or needs the support that they actually do need.
Hmm. Yeah, I've got a friend and comrade whose daughter is on the autism spectrum. He tried to take her to swimming lessons, which is, you know, parenting 101. Take your kid to swimming lessons. This is really important so they don't drown. She can't handle the swimming lessons because she's overstimulated. It's a very noisy, echoey environment. Now, there's an NDIS-run service, which is a therapeutic thing for kids on the autism spectrum or the ADHD, and it provides therapy to those kids, and almost as a byproduct of that, it also acts as like swimming lessons. So he enrolls his daughter in this class. It's an eligible service to be sending her to under the NDIS rules. And they knock her back and they say, nah, NDIS can't be used to cover swimming lessons. He says, well, it's not really swimming lessons. First of all, she can't go to regular swimming lessons. It doesn't work. We've tried it. Second of all, this is not swimming lessons in inverted commas. It's a water-based therapy program, which, okay, the kids come out of it with better swimming skills. And the NDIS paid, you know, would have paid more to have a lawyer because this was challenged in court, and the NDIS paid a lawyer to argue the case that you're not allowed to send your daughter to this service, and they would have spent more money on this lawyer than they would have spent just approving this voucher and letting her get this run of lessons or this water-based service. So, yeah, that is absolutely spot on. The amount of money that gets spent on bureaucrats and lawyers whose job it is to deny people access to vouchers under the NDIS is just disgraceful.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, well, I'm going to go play a quick announcement, and maybe we'll go take a bit of break from this discussion. We'll go to another news story. Follow Green Left and because we have some articles and some potential interviews kind of coming up on the impact of Labor's cuts, and we're obviously going to be committed to you know, supporting any campaign against these NDIS cuts. We'll definitely support any kind of protests or actions that will come out in response to this, because I think this is going to be, you know, a big kind of important issue that we'll need to be addressing in future programs. We'll play a quick announcement. You're listening to Green Left Radio.
The revolution in Rojava is a beacon of hope for the world, putting direct democracy and feminism into practice on a broad scale. This radical attempt at social transformation now faces huge challenges, including daily attacks by the Turkish military with little outside recognition or aid. Show your support for Rojava by joining Northeast Syria Solidarity, or NESS, and help ensure the survival of this inspiring experiment in social change. NESS sends aid, raises awareness, and builds solidarity. Get involved at www.nesssolidarity.org.au. NESS is a 3CR supporter.
Okay. You're listening to Green Left Radio on 3CR 855 AM. I'd play a track by Yuma Hiroto, which is a Japanese hip-hop producer. And this is a track called Soul of Freedom, which also features the hip-hop rapper Sizz Star. Hope listeners enjoy.
In the abyss, ask yourself a question quickly, why the hell do I exist? Is it for a handbag or $200 kicks, or helping your fellow man that is down and out sick? This is it, the question that defines the essence, material gains or an inner soul blessing. Lady or the tiger, people will keep you guessing. Hopefully we investing in the right progression. Aggression keeps us under, pride asunder. Greed is the plunder, hell harder than summer. Selling yourself for what you call is to come up. Quick money spends funny and it never sums up. Before you know you're broken, weighted down and frozen. Stuck in the depression on the path that you've chosen. Needed some progression but you're holding on to totems. You need to pull away, free yourself and now you're open. Looking through a different view and seeing that you'll make it through. When you want to save yourself, you see the ones that's helping you. Push away the others that will pull you down asunder. Crabs in the bucket, always want to have a brother. Just move it undercover, let them get another sucker. By the time they even notice you're out, you're seeing wonders. A lover and a fighter that's filled with true desire. Trial by the fire, a trailblazer that's higher. Using my leverage for life, pushing through the strife as we crawl through the light. If we make it through, we gon' walk it upright. Watch it how we move it, we gon' make it all right. Using my leverage for life, pushing through the strife as we crawl through the night. If we make it through, we gon' walk it upright. Watch it how we move it, we gon' make it all right. Using my leverage for life, pushing through the strife as we crawl through the light. If we make it through, we gon' walk it upright. Watch it how we move it, we gon' make it all right. Using my leverage for life, pushing through the strife as we crawl through the night. If we make it through, we gon' walk it upright. Watch it how we move it, we gon' make it all right. Steadfast in my notions while I'm rising out the ocean. Love is a devotion, number 9 is the potion. Keys in my pocket, in my face, the doors are closing. Only if they knew I already had the means to open. Wasted their time to hold me back, remain in motion. Wonder if they even notice their efforts just keep me focused. This is the Redeemer, spitting promise through the speaker. Just a brand new creature starring in this life feature. Seeing bigger pictures when I'm looking in the mirror. Used to sit the sidelines, now I stand and deliver. My brother, this is scripture, water pouring out the pitcher. Hoping you can get the deeper meaning in the mixture. We living for the day, making ways for tomorrow. Understanding sorrow, but the motto is Apollo. This tune isn't auto, money worship and bravado. But understanding yourself and your vessel never hollow. The mind foundation, soul is a creation. Body is a temple to house a situation. We're just a league of nations, different faces, same basis. It's gonna take some patience, but the goal is
still elation. Rise to the occasion, my people, we gonna make it. Everyday dedication to find a new equation. Deleting the delusion while we searching for solutions. Concluding the confusion while we ready resolutions. Using my leverage for life, pushing through the strife as we crawl through the light. If we make it through, we gon' walk it upright. Watch it how we move it, we gon' make it alright. Using my leverage for life, pushing through the strife as we crawl through the night. If we make it through, we gon' walk it upright. Watch it how we move it, we gon' make it alright. Using my leverage for life, pushing through the strife as we crawl through the light. If we make it through, we gon' walk it upright. Watch it how we move it, we gon' make it alright. Using my leverage for life, pushing through the strife as we crawl through the night. If we make it through, we gon' walk it upright. Watch it how we move it, we gon' make it alright.
All right, you're listening. That was Soul of Freedom by Yumeya Hiroto. Very kind of nice sort of jazzy track to listen to in the morning. Now, we're going to go into some more kind of news kind of discussion. But there was quite a lot that actually happened over in the kind of past weekend in Queensland. Because essentially in Queensland, and in fact, I wonder if even reporting this, you'd be able to listen to it in Queensland. But of course, I'm not completely familiar with the laws. But basically, the Queensland government, as we kind of reported in previous programs, has banned the Palestine freedom slogans "from the river to the sea" and "globalize the intifada," except in some circumstances. And essentially, there were a number, there was a rally, Justice for Palestine, which is the sort of main kind of activist group that is organizing protests in Mianjin, in so-called Brisbane. There was basically... activists got arrested for expressing or displaying the banned phrase "from the river to the sea." And of course, there was also a very fun kind of flash mob sort of action where hundreds of people sang and danced along to John Farnham's "Two Strong Hearts" because the song has the line "river to the sea." And in fact, one of the funniest things is if you watch, there was actually a channel, there was actually a mural of that. And I think we reported on that in our previous Green Left radio program, but that mural was actually censored, because it literally just quoted the song. It was a mural of John Farnham with a Palestine flag and a watermelon, and then it just had his lines "river to the sea," and that got censored. And then when the Channel 9 reported on it, they actually censored the phrase from the song, which is just completely ridiculous. So essentially, Justice for Palestine Mianjin has announced that it's going to coordinate a high court challenge to Queensland's so-called hate speech laws. And, you know, they have basically, at a rally on April 19th, they basically said that, you know, these laws attack not only the freedom of speech of Queenslanders, but also attack on the humanity of Palestinians. Now, Carol described these, the laws, leading Jewish activist and Queensland Progressive member Edward Carroll was the first to be arrested on April 18th, where he was speaking in front of a banner which read "Jews Against Genocide." Carroll described the laws as bad laws that are poorly written, and that he proudly joins the many organisations that are calling for the laws to be repealed. And he said it was actually insulting for the Queensland Liberal National Premier to say that his laws are about protecting Jewish people. "You cannot continue the lie that criticising Israel is an act of anti-Semitism," Carroll said. And really, I mean, the Carroll told the Cow that he warned the Premier that if the government went ahead with these laws, he would be faced with images of Jewish people being arrested for saying "from the river to the sea." So yeah, this is I think there's a lot obviously happening in this, but I mean, I think, you know, it's I think all the solidarity to Palestine solidarity activists in Queensland who are doing everything they can to resist these laws. I think there's also a petition sort of going around that's been promoted in the Victoria, basically calling on the Allen government to not implement any laws along these lines. Although I think at this point they haven't announced any laws along these lines quite yet. And in fact, there has been a bit, I think since the Isaac Herzog protests, like the massive protests against Isaac Herzog, I do think that there has been an element of retreat from some of the governments. And of course, there was actually a big significant victory in New South Wales where there was a high court challenge basically that in New South Wales that basically ruled that the anti-protest laws that were implemented following the Bondi massacre were deemed
unconstitutional. Yeah, and then Chris Minns, the Labor right New South Wales Premier, has turned around since then and said, "Oh, well, I don't apologise for implementing those laws," and is now saying we're going to implement a copy of the Queensland laws banning globalised the Intifada and from the river to the sea, which... Dude, like, read the room and learn the lesson. Stop trying to implement unconstitutional attacks on freedom of speech, you right-wing clown.
Well, but also I think it's also, like, the thing about Chris Minns is he, like, ever since the kind of, like, ever since, like, 2 years ago following October 7 in 2023 with the big sort of outpouring of support for Palestine solidarity, he every conscious attempt he has made to kind of repress the Palestine movement, he has received the most significant kind of pushback and has I think in some sense been consistently humiliated by the Palestine solidarity movement. Like, you know, I can't think of a premier that has just had more defeats. He's kept overreaching consistently and just being defeated every time. Like, I don't know what...
He also tried to stop the people's blockade of the world's largest coal port up in Mullumbimby, Newcastle, using special events legislation, which was basically put there to allow for speedboat racing and yachting and stuff to happen in the harbour, to get all the tinnies out and say, all right, you can't go fishing in the middle of the harbour today because there's speedboats there. And he tried to use that legislation to stop the blockade happening and said, there's a special event, you're not allowed in the harbour. The special event is the blockade and we're blocking it for the blockade. And the lawyers for Rising Tide were like, so hang on, the special event that you're blocking the harbour for to allow it to happen is the thing that you're blocking? What? That's the what sort of exotic logic is this? And yeah, the Supreme Court kicked it out and we were able to have the blockade. So yeah, he's just a really right wing repressive clown, but also like quite bumbling and incompetent.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, just the constant kind of defeats. Because I think, I mean, to give some credit to some of the other Labor premiers, I just don't think the Labor premiers have like even Jacinda Allen in Victoria. You know, she is obviously right wing. She's obviously promoted Israel and supported and not been a friend of the Palestine Solidarity Movement at all. But even they, when you compare someone like Jacinda Allen to Chris Minns, Jacinda Allen hasn't gone for the same level of overreach that Chris Minns has consistently kind of gone to. You know, there's been obviously small little repressive things they've done here and there. And of course, the anti-protest laws that have been implemented by the state government, which is really, you know, targeting people who wear face masks, etc., that kind of thing. They've not gone as far as the Chris Minns government, but of course, the Chris Minns government has just been consistently defeated with the overreach. And I think that High Court sort of ruling is just one of the many kind of examples of that.
Word.
Now, just another story I just want to highlight is basically something that happened in the University of Queensland. So essentially, Indigenous children's book, where basically, I mean, the book is titled "Billa, a River Cycle" by award-winning Awuyundru poet Jazz Money, and was illustrated by Matt Chun. Now, the insanity thing has basically been that the University of Queensland Press has made a last-minute decision to essentially scrap the book, despite the fact that it's already printed, like 5,000 copies of the book. It was going to be released this year, etc. Are essentially going to be scrapped because they found that past comments by the illustrator were found to have breached the university's policy on anti-Semitism. I think I have my sort of political differences with the particular article that, you know, the University of Queensland found issue with by Matt Shun. But at the end of the day, like, there's this whole kind of madness in terms of universities claim to be, you know, kind of like defenders of kind of free speech and academic integrity. Yet you're seeing that university managements are going down this kind of special direction, including adopting the IHRCA, or what's the acronym again?
IHRC.
Yeah, well, listeners will probably know that the definition of
anti-human rights something.
I think international Holocaust remembrance sort of definition of anti-Semitism. So they're adopting
like
that
any criticism of Israel,
which
is
basically says any criticism of Israel is
ridiculous.
Yeah, absolutely ridiculous. You know, you're seeing these university institutions bend over backwards to essentially defend Israel in a way. And so now they're basically go look for any excuse or any means to kind of cancel authors and so on, and, you know, which I just think it's like you've never seen this with any other kind of political movement. You certainly don't see authors or academics getting cancelled for presenting pro Israel views, but for anything that is just criticism of Israel and Zionism is essentially getting this struck. And I guess one positive thing that sort of happened is a number of Indigenous authors, have cut ties with the publisher University of Queensland Press after its scrapped publication of this Indigenous authors picture book. And so, yeah, obviously that's a bit of an embarrassment for the University of Queensland. And of course, there's a number of other Indigenous authors and Arabic and Palestinian authors who have also said they'll stop publishing with University of Queensland Press following the decision not to publish Jazz Honey and Shun's children's book. So, you know, I think all the solidarity to these artists. And I think what's been sort of happening in the cultural sphere, you know, especially with the Adelaide Writers Festival, I think has been some of the most powerful demonstrations of solidarity and the impact that the Palestine Solidarity Movement has sort of had.
Word. All right. Well, we should probably go to a bit of a break and get Brooke on the phone.
Yeah. You're listening to Green Left Radio.
The media in this country, we as Indigenous people know, have censored our right of telling the truth. And the truth is what this country is most fearful of, in particular Indigenous truths. Until history is told by the vanquished lens, which is our people telling our story our way, and have the right to be able to incorporate that into a system of learning, well, people are always going to be denied that truth by deceit and lies. When you look at the type of psychological warfare and spiritual warfare that Aboriginal people are caught in, it's not just in the sense of military when they talk about weapons of mass destruction, but you're right, it's in terms of the media, and the industry of media is a warfare against our people, and so is religion, I believe, in the Western sense. They're all weapons of mass destruction against our people.
We need to keep radical voices on air. Subscribe now.
Go to 3cr.org.au/subscribe or call the station on 9419 8377.
The organisation. organisation I work with, 3CR Community Radio, has been our partner for the last 45 years. And they've always been a part of our struggle, particularly on Invasion Day. And today they're doing a whole day of broadcasting and programming around Invasion Day, as they usually do for the last couple of decades. They've done that for us. I just want to acknowledge the 3CR mob.
Okay, we're back listening to Green Left Radio on 3CR 855 AM, and we're very happy to be joined by our first live interview for the program. I'll pass on to Zane to introduce her.
All right, and just before we start this interview, just a bit of a content warning. We are going to be discussing sexual assault and trauma. So if you haven't got the chops for that this morning, that's cool. Maybe just tune out for the next 10 or 15. All right, so on the phone, we have got Brooke Forbes. Brooke is a lawyer, new author, survivor and mental health advocate from Newcastle, New South Wales, who's currently working and living in Arundel Lands in Mbantwa, Alice Springs. After a decade-long career in the media and tech industry, Brooke survived a sexual assault at the hands of her then managing director, which eventually resulted in a mental health decline that saw her sectioned twice in psychosis. The first thing Brooke did when recovering was enroll in her dream degree at the University of Newcastle, Law, and graduated in 2024. While studying law and working as a mental health peer support worker, Brooke became passionate about social justice, where after graduating, Brooke was employed by the Aboriginal Legal Service in Mullumbimby, Newcastle, and then in the Central Australia Women's Legal Service in Alice Springs. Brooke's new book, Survival is an Instinct, blends fiction and non-fiction, creating a multi-layered portrayal of surviving mental health diagnoses and sexual assault. Survival is an Instinct asks whether justice can be achieved through the very act of surviving, looks at where the legal system is failing survivors, and talks to the exploitation of workplace power dynamics. Welcome, Brooke.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's, yeah, it's very good to have you on this morning, and yeah, really, really cool that you've got this book out. So, Brooke, the book tells the story of you being subjected to a workplace sexual assault, the impact of that on your world and in particular on your mental health and then your recovery and rebuilding your life. Can you give us a bit of a rundown of that?
Yeah, sure. So before I start, I'd like to acknowledge the Arunda people on whose land I'm currently working and playing, and like to pay my respects to elders past, present and emerging. I'd also quite like to acknowledge and pay respects to all survivor stories. So I hope that by sharing my own, I'm contributing to this visual of what I think about, which is that I think it's like a tapestry weaving its way through institutions, systems and individuals who need to listen and learn from our stories. But also I hope it wraps around other survivors in a way that's therapeutic and affirming. Having the chance to reclaim your story is a very powerful thing. So I think that I thank you for the opportunity to do that today. My story starts in the Australian media and tech industry, where I worked for a good part of a decade in my 20s and 30s. And like you stated, during this time, I worked for a company who seemed to be very shiny. They seemed to be very professional and polished, but I actually walked into quite a nightmare. And I don't use that term lightly, as it reflects on the living nightmare that I endured in psychosis down the track. Unfortunately, I was sexually assaulted twice at the hands of my managing director while working at this company. The company then fired the managing director, but they also pushed me out. And I suffered very poor mental health as a result. I also went through some corporate bullying as I tried to move into other jobs in the field. Eventually, I moved from Sydney to Newcastle and fell into psychosis twice. So this psychosis was heavily punctuated with themes of sexual assault and political battles. And as a result, I was diagnosed with schizophrenia and subsequently schizoaffective disorder. So just to make it clear, this could have happened without the assault. So I could have, at some stage in my life, fallen into psychosis. But I'm with a firm belief, and it's of medical advice, that what I experienced in the tech industry and the media industry triggered these psychotic episodes from stress and trauma. But when I was healing, I started a law degree and finished it in 2024, which led me to my current state as being a lawyer, living with mental illness and advocating for others. So I can understand that digesting all of that is big. It's a big story, which is why I decided to write elements of it down with the aim of hoping to help other people who have overcome either sexual assault or living with mental illness.
Yeah, nice. One of the things I really like about your book is the way that it starts by outlining the assault and the trauma from that. And then you also talk about the title of the book, Survival is an Instinct, looks at how that psychotic episode you went into was almost a particular type of protective mechanism that your brain recedes into. And you're kind of retreated into these stories to escape from the trauma and try and push it out of your mind for a period of time while you processed it. And I like how the structure of your book starts with describing the assault and the trauma, but then it goes into a bunch of short stories which are sort of unrelated to that, and then towards the end of the book it comes back to the assault and the trauma. And it's almost like your book reflects that journey, and it gives the reader time to process this pretty heavy and full-on stuff at the start, and then you go on a bit of a journey, and then you come back to that, and it's like you're more ready to look at those what you've got to say towards the end of the book about the assault and your recovery and rebuilding your life.
It was definitely a strange genre to choose. It's kind of genre blending between fiction and non-fiction. But I did that, and I was like, it's a creative journal of what I was thinking at the time, and also retelling some stories that I had written previously that reflect on different stages of my life and what storytelling means to me. So storytelling and creativity was one of the mechanisms I used to pull myself out of psychosis and reclaim my sanity. And that process was really important. I actually wrote some of the stories in the book in psychosis. So I was writing while I was unwell. But sometimes you couldn't write. The voices inside your head were too overpowering. But there were points of more clarity where I was recovering slightly, where I could sit down and I wrote a whole short story in that period. And I think that it really reflects on not just that that psychosis is a protective mechanism for your mind for trauma, but also that, people carry a lot of stigma about psychosis and what it means to be in that state. We see people being, in the news for very negative things, and psychosis is thrown about, but there's not much written about how it can inform your mind, or how it can, and I don't want to glorify it because it's not something that should be the norm, but it is a process that can, enrich your perception of yourself.
Yeah, I found that a really interesting insight, and it really kind of, your book really debunks or kind of gives you insight into that process of psychosis. All right, now you've experienced the shortcomings of the legal system for victim survivors firsthand, and then additionally, as part of rebuilding your life, you've successfully completed a law degree, which is quite impressive. What are your views on the way patriarchy is sort of embedded in the legal system, and conversely, what would a fit-for-purpose legal framework that protects women and delivers justice for victim survivors look like? How would that be? How could that be different to the existing system?
Yeah, sure. So I want to start by saying the patriarchy is everywhere. It's in our language, it's in our systems, it's in our job descriptions. So for me, a big area to start with for reform is trauma-informed practices from the police. When I eventually reported my sexual assault to the police then said it would have been better if he had punched you in the face. This is because I was heavily coerced rather than it being forceful. And I understand that, but it's not something that you should be saying to a victim in a position of power when you're presenting in a very vulnerable state. I mean, like, better for who? Who would it have been better for if he had punched me in the face? So training and appropriate dealing with victims and the police in this area is an area I'd like to see reform. I quickly found avenues for criminal justice for slamming in my face. So, and this is quite a hard pill to swallow after surviving so much trauma at the hands of someone you should have been able to trust. I was offered a pretext call, which is where I call my abuser and get him to confess over the phone, and it's recorded as the next only available option for investigation. You can imagine how traumatising that would be, and also how odd that would be given the amount of time had lapsed after I reported. I think it was 6 or 7 years. And that 6 or 7 years are a really important time where I fell into psychosis. That, you know, took up the better part of... It was a couple of months each time, but each time you fall into it, you need months and months to recover. So I think it was 2 years I lost in and out of psychosis and subsequent therapies. I don't know how you're supposed to advocate for yourself and report in that period if you're that unwell. So I was coming to them with this information as soon as I could, and the response was lacking, to say the least. So secondly, there's avenues through the civil system, but they often also have a time limit. So there's a few ways around this, but essentially vicarious liability law, which sues the employer, asks them to be re-traumatised before they have actually healed. So again, the time limits on legislation don't really account for someone to be able to heal and then seek justice. So, yeah, I think in an ideal world, we'd be looking at a system that takes into account healing as a person and allows them to seek a form of justice that obviously it needs to be proven standard. Beyond reasonable doubt, and then on a civil standard on the balance of probabilities. But to be able to prove these things, you should be able to do it retrospectively, and it should be something that the police and the civil support a survivor in doing.
Now, in Australia and around the world, there's been numerous cases in recent years of powerful men being accused of sexual assaults of women and children, but in many cases they haven't been held to account, or they've evaded liability by threatening to sue for defamation or actually doing the thing and suing. Can you comment on this lack of accountability for powerful men? What sort of message does that send to society as a whole, either for victim survivors, but also to men? And you know,
So I think, first of all, I'd like to note that shame needs to shift sides. So I kind of reject the narrative where victims have to live in silence or shame and accept what happens to them as part of their life. And a lot of the power play is that they hold that power over you, and the power that you will be ashamed to speak up, the power that you will be sued if you do speak up. And if we are systematically or as individuals can build systems where survivor stories are told and listened to, and that can be special advocacy groups, it can be media outlets like yourselves that are allowing survivors to speak, we can hold powerful men to account. Unfortunately, I've chosen, and this has been a battle, I've chosen not to name the media outlet or my abuser in any of the book or media that I'm doing. I wish I could have, but legally it's much of a risk. And again, that's another mechanism that's silencing survivors. So, you know, in reflecting on that, I think that we can tell our story, though. We can reclaim our past through storytelling. And, you know, the act of surviving itself can be a form of justice is one of the conclusions that I came to. And that took a lot of time for me to accept. It wasn't an easy thought. I wanted either criminal justice or civil law justice. But we can achieve a form of justice where you're healthy, survive, and maybe even thriving without the help of the legal system itself, which, you know, obviously we want the legal system to start, but for the survivors that are out there who have been rejected by the legal system, I suppose you need to turn up self, and only you can do that healing, but there is a sense of justice in seeing today as it comes. I think quickly I'd like to quote Barbara, who I saw at Pajama Festival.
Oh, word.
Yeah, she was amazing. I loved her so much. We saw her for free, which was such a blessing. And he says that if you can't digest the truth, let them choke on it, which I think is pretty profound.
Yes. Barker's dope. All right, we're probably got to wrap it up. So you're launching your book, Survival is an Instinct, in Bantwa next weekend. Can you tell listeners about the short fiction competition that you're running as part of launching the book, and also how can listeners get their hands on a copy of the book?
Yeah, for sure. So I thought I'd have a bit of fun, and I've got a free ebook giveaway. So if you are that way inclined and you want to email me some microlit or some poetry around the theme of survival, I've limited it to 20 lines max, so it's very short. And the top 10 will receive a free ebook. So you can email me at brooke.anne.forbes@gmail.com. I've already got some great entries, so that's really cool. And then you can check out my website to buy the book. So that's www.brookeforbeswrites.com. And the book launches at Red Kangaroo Books on the 2nd of May at 2:30.
Rock and roll. All right.
Yeah.
Thanks heaps for speaking with us. And I think it takes great courage both to talk about mental illness and also the sexual assault that you've suffered. And, yeah, much respect. And I hope the book launch goes well.
Thank you. Thanks for your time.
Yeah, thanks again, Brooke.
Thank you.
All right. That was Brooke Forbes, author of Survival is an Instinct. And if you look at the Green Left Radio Facebook page, we'll post a link to Brooke's website so you can get a copy of that book and maybe enter the micro-lit or poetry comp. If this interview has been confronting for you and you need to talk to someone who can assist you in processing that, don't try and get through it yourself. Talk to someone who's equipped to help you with that. So call 1-800-RESPECT. It's free service and they're well trained and they'll provide you that support. All right, you're listening to Green Left Radio on 3CR.
Kufiyas are Palestinian scarves, and they're a symbol of support for justice for the Palestinian people. From the traditional black and white kufiya to an array of modern designs, explore the range and order online or drop by 3CR during business hours. Wear your support for the rights of Palestinians. Go to kufiyas.org.au. That's kufiyas.org.au. A 3CR supporter.
All right, you're listening to Green Left Radio on 3CR 855 AM. So now it's time for the Green Left Activist Calendar. So yeah, just a note, you can look up the listings for a lot of these events on the Green Left website by going on greenleft.org.au/events. So some of the events that are going to be coming up is tonight at 7 p.m. there's going to be a radical book club on the Aboriginal struggle and the left. So they'll be happening on Friday, April the tonight, 7 p.m. at the Visitor Centre, level 5407 Swanston Street. It's actually a short book, so you can actually get a look on the Green Left website and you can get a copy of the PDF to read the book. Some other events kind of happening is there's going to be also a picket against Ansell, ending modern slavery, and that's going to be happening at 1 p.m. at the Ansell head office at 678 Victoria Street in Richmond. Then there'll be the Critical Mass ride from State Library to Sydney Road at 5:30 p.m. at the State Library. Now, the Critical Mass is like a regular sort of mass sort of mobilisation of cyclists, and it's generally focused on the politics of, you know, better cycling infrastructure and making demands of the state governments to implement it. Then on Saturday, April the 25th to Sunday, the April the 26th, there is a call out for Camp Sovereignty to maintain a presence. So from 5 p.m. on Saturday, April the 25th. So that's at King's Domain. Then there'll be a few other events. There's a few other events happening, including there's another event at Camp Sovereignty happening also at 5 p.m. Honouring our four fallen warriors. Then on Sunday, April the 26th, there's going to be a Rising Tide Victoria coffee catch-up, and that'll be happening at 10:30 a.m. at the Bicycle Thieves Cafe, 449 High Street in Northcote. And then there's also going to be a webinar, Breaking the Siege on Gaza, Internationalist Solidarity and the Global Sumud Flotilla. So probably many of our listeners are probably aware that the Global Sumud Flotilla is actually starting to launch. And actually, I think there's more than 16 Australian activists who are kind of participating in it alongside many other activists from all over the world. It's actually going to be the biggest flotilla yet. I'm definitely looking forward to kind of hearing reports about it. And I think, we'll definitely conscious of announcing any solidarity actions depending on Israel's actions in response to the flotilla. Then on Monday, April the 27th, there'll be a vigil for Chernobyl, 40 years on, and that'll be happening at 5:30 p.m. at the St. Paul's Cathedral at 200 Flinders Street in the city. Then on Tuesday, April 28th, there'll be an International Workers' Memorial Day at 10:30 a.m. That is happening on April 28th. Yeah, I just confused the time because I thought it was the same time as the May Day marching, but no, that's the following Tuesday. Uh-huh. Then there'll be a public forum, Solidarity with Cuba, opposing the US blockade, and that'll be happening at 6:30 p.m. at the Resistance Centre, level 5407 Swanston Street. On Thursday, April the 30th, there'll be a number of May Day events organised by the Trades Hall, including a Reef Lane at 5 p.m. at the 8-hour monument and an International Solidarity and Multicultural event at the Victoria Trades Hall. On Friday, May the 1st, there'll be the May Day International Workers' Day mass rally at 6 p.m. at the State Library.
And tune in here to 3CR next Friday because there's going to be a big May Day special. You know, talking to a whole lot of unionists and I guess, you know, a lot of 3CR listeners know about May Day, know about the union movement, but some listeners may be a bit new to this stuff. And so we'll try and hit the sweet spot, provide some cool stories if you're someone who's experienced on the page about unions and May Day, but also provide some, dare I say it, political education for people who are a bit new to this and wanting to know more.
Now, the next, just a few other events to highlight is there's going to be another May Day march by the May Day Committee on Sunday, the 3rd of May at 1 p.m. at the Victorian Trades Hall. There'll also be a solidarity concert for Timor-Leste, and they'll be at the MUA Auditorium, 46 to 54 Island Street in West Melbourne. And then on Tuesday, May the 5th, there'll be the Council Workers Strike, ASU Mass Rally at 10 a.m. at the Victorian Trades Hall. I think there'll be a very big, important protest to kind of attend. And then just note, on Sunday, May the 17th, there'll be the NACBAR Day Rally. And I think that will happen at 12 p.m. at the State Library. And then there'll be another rally on saving public housing at 11 a.m. at the State Library on Saturday, May the 30th.
Now, just something to put on people's radar as well, there is a Hume City Council meeting happening on Monday night, this coming Monday night, the 27th at 7 p.m. There may be some sort of community solidarity action with striking ASU workers, probably from around 6. There's just been a bit of a buzz going around the grapevine about doing some sort of action there. So keep an eye out for that one. Another thing I just wanted to give a quick plug for, I'm a member of Defend the Unions, Defend the CFMEU. At the moment, we are doing a raffle to raise funds for legal support for CFMEU staff and organisers who have been arbitrarily and unfairly dismissed by the administrator and given no explanation. Under the admin laws, admin can do that. So we're having a raffle raising funds to provide legal support to those staff and organisers who've been sacked, who wish to challenge that in court. And late last year, there was a successful action where OHS organiser, highly respected activist Esther Van Arendt, was able to successfully challenge her dismissal by admin. So there is precedent for getting victories in the court, but we need to fundraise for that, because the usual place that legal support would come from is the union itself, but the union is under admin and they're not going to provide legal support to people challenging them, which is part of the whole problem with admin. It's like, yeah, there's no separation of powers. You've got Fair Work, who are the place to go to, and they're controlling a union. Anyway,
yeah.
Defend the unions, defend the CFMEU, get a raffle ticket, $20 each, $50 for three.
All right, thanks for that. So just a note, you can get you can look at all these a lot of the listings of these events on the Green Left website at greenleft.org.au/events. To get to play a quick announcement, because we want to get into our second and final live interview for the program.
The law is part of our everyday lives, including when we buy something, use a service, have a job, or rent a house. The law can be used to help protect and support families when there is violence in the home or disputes over parenting arrangements. Sometimes we might need to understand the law to navigate specific government systems like Centrelink, getting a residency visa, or if we come into contact with the police. Community legal centres provide free, quality legal advice and assistance to help people with everyday legal problems. We focus on working with people who are experiencing disadvantage, such as financial hardship, family violence, homelessness, and discrimination. Community legal centres are independent, non-government organisations and can be found across Victoria and Australia. If you're experiencing a legal problem, your local community legal centre may be able to help. To find a community legal centre near you, visit the Federation of Community Legal Centres Victoria at www.fclc.org.au. A 3CR supporter.
Okay, you're listening to Green Left Radio on 3CR 855 AM. And we're very happy to be joined by the Secretary of the Australian Services Union in Victoria, Tash Wark, who has basically been leading the union for representing council workers in this big dispute with more than 8 councils involved. Good morning, Tash. Good morning, Tash.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. I'm sorry, I just forgot to press a button when so I wasn't able to hear you now, but we can hear you now. Good morning, Tash. As I gave a bit of an introduction, the ASU is currently in the midst of dispute with council workers, in particular fighting for better wages and conditions. The negotiation is also an example, I think, of a multi-employee agreement where you're currently negotiating with more than 8 councils. Can you give us a bit of a background on the dispute and kind of what's been the kind of council's kind of response?
Thanks so much, Jacob. Absolutely can. So we are working with members across 8 councils, as you said. So that is City of Melbourne, Greater Dandenong, Darebin, Hobsons Bay, Hume, Maribyrnong, Marybeck and Yarra. So they joined together. Members opted into multi-employer bargaining. They did a whole lot of activity at their work sites to win majority support. We had a number of councils being quite hostile during that process. So it's actually taken about a year and a half just to get to the bargaining table. So we're talking about agreements that, you know, as of the middle of this year, you know, workers won't have had a proper pay rise for 2 years. So our members are really feeling the pinch. They are, because of the whole collection of things, like wage rises that are lower than they should be in comparison to the cost of living and inflation and so forth, but also some state government policies, which I'll come back to. Basically, they've been losing about 7 to 12% of their wages in real terms just since about 2021.
Yeah, and can you tell us a bit about, I guess, your log of claims? Like, what is the sort of demands that you're trying to kind of negotiate in terms of pay increases?
Absolutely. So we are trying to keep the log of claims fairly simple and straightforward. What we are aiming to do with the structure of the agreement is have some common terms like the pay increase, which I'll come back to, and then like a handful of other items. And basically then that workers keep everything that they have in their current agreements in an appendix in the back of that multi-employer agreement. So no one goes backwards, no one loses anything that they have. We're not talking about trying to overcomplicate things and trying to harmonise 8 quite complex, you know, and quite, you know, in some ways different, in some ways quite similar agreements. So the kind of pay claims that they put forward are 10% in the first year, followed by 4% for 3 years thereafter. So it's about 23.7% over the life of the agreement. We think that doesn't go probably all of the way to making up, but we're trying to be somewhat, you know, realistic about the environment that members are bargaining in. They're doing it tough, like I said.
Yeah. The next kind of question I want to kind of ask is about, I mean, how you are building, I guess, like how is the union sort of dealing with the kind of issue of building support for the community within the strike? Because obviously one of the impacts that this council worker that this strike is obviously happening is you've taken a number of kind of actions, including refusing to kind of pick up kind of rubbish, etc. How are you kind of going to be building kind of support within the community for this industrial action? I mean, I completely support this industrial action, but obviously there's some residents who will be, oh, you know, my rubbish hasn't been picked up, etc. And there's also been the kind of disgraceful actions, I think, of councils who have actually hired scab labour to pick up the rubbish.
Yep, we have had Marybeck and Hume unfortunately go and hire contract labour in. And in some cases doing things like Marybeck sent out trucks early, breaching their own provisions. So we know that they are really trying to undermine the action. I mean, we're doing a lot of work with members to try and hold it together. They're all doing bargaining for the first time this way. There's actually quite a bit of support coming in from the community, and we know that there's differential impact for residents, like people whose rubbish fills up really quickly. They might have small children and have got nappies, or, you know, we've heard some examples from the media of, you know, people with adult incontinence and maybe having 2 adults in a household, so their bins are filling up really quickly and, you know, like it's not pleasant. I guess we really appreciate everyone's patience and support, and we really encourage people to contact their council. So contact the councillors, contact the customer service lines, where we do have members as well, and let them know, you know, that you want this addressed as quickly as possible. We think that councils could be doing a better job at the bargaining table. Like, they're turning up unprepared, not having read clauses that they've had for, you know, 2 months. Like, you know, they are saying that the union is, you know, being difficult, obviously, but actually they could be making this a whole lot smoother.
Tash, there goes us again. So,
all right, Tash, here you go. My name's Zane. I'm a CFMEU member. I'm just keen to ask about this multi-employer bargaining process. Labor created those laws, I think it was during their previous term, but I don't know, we haven't seen that much of the multi-employer bargaining process yet. So as a organiser, how has that process been? What's it like?
Look, we found it really exciting and our members have been really embracing of it. So generally what we've done is gone out to sites when their expiry of their agreement is kind of in the lead-in and say, you could either multi-employer bargain and here's who we think that you could bargain with, and do a bit of a consultation process with members. So not all sites have gotten across the line, either because it hasn't been appealing to members. More so in the metro areas it has been. In some of our regional sites, it's been a bit of a mix. We did get a multi-employer agreement across the line in regional local government late last year. That was fought tooth and nail by one of the councils. So one council consented. Thank you, Ararat, Rural City Council. Central Goldfields fought it all the way. So I think that it provides obviously an amazing opportunity to just have a lot of conversations with workers, because there will have to be some kind of majority support activity. So from an organising point of view, from a point of view of showing the value of being in the union, of supporting what is going on, and really looping people, it gives delegates and organisers a lot of opportunities to have a lot of one-on-one conversations with people. We think that the value in that is talking to people about what do they want to see change in their workplace. And overwhelmingly in this bargain, it has been pay by far and above. Like, people want other things in their workplace, but pay was just a massive, you know, issue because, as I said before, in real terms, it's been going backwards. So I think you've got some good examples out there. The VIEU is doing some stuff around multi-employer bargaining in Catholic schools at the moment. So you could look a bit at how they're approaching that. Obviously, a different thing. I know there's other unions that are considering this. I think there's some pockets of other examples. But for this action, this will be the strike on the 5th of May, will be the biggest probably action in decades and decades and decades of local government workers walking off the job together.
And what's the process for getting that EBA up? Can individual councils sign up and you tick them off as you go? Or does there have to be a ballot of everyone at all of those workplaces at the same time?
To join in the process, we have to demonstrate. So, A, an employer can consent. There's one employer so far that has consented off the bat. That is Ararat, and in that regional group. In the metro group, we've had to do a variety of majority support activities. Some councils have respected the union's majority support. We've collected petitions. Some councils have said they want to run their own ballot and then we've agreed to some protocols around how that ballot will run, and then they have said that they will respect the outcome of that. Some councils have tried to put out single employer agreements that tried to, you know, kind of bribe workers away by offering a bit more pay but not what members are claiming, to try and peel them off, because if workers enter into single enterprise bargaining, well, multi-employer bargaining kind of isn't consented to yet and authorised by the Fair Work Commission, then they're not eligible to join in that multi-employer group. So there's a little bit of technical stuff to navigate, but, I mean, we're finding that it is navigable. Like, when members understand and you're explaining to them and talking to them about what do they want, that this is there's a massive benefit to bargaining this way. So workers, through their union, control when that MEB goes out to the vote. That is a massive game changer. I don't know about in your industries, but repeatedly in local government we see stuff like, you know, councils kind of, you know, dragging bargaining out, waiting till just before Christmas when everyone needs money, and then they put a shit agreement out to the vote, or waiting until there's like seasonal numbers that distort the voting numbers. This really does give the power back to, you know, our members in the workplace to say, all right, we're ready to call it now. Like, this is the deal we're happy with. Like, let's go. And then it goes to the vote. So that's a massive game changer. Local government couldn't bargain this way before those, you know, changes that you mentioned obviously came into play. The other one is being able to take industrial action in a multi-employer bargaining process. So that hasn't been possible under the previous provision. So those things paired together, and there's a couple of other odds and ends, you know, have really changed some of that in favour of our members.
All right. Well, we're getting to a bit to the end of the program. The final kind of question I want to sort of ask you is, can you tell our listeners about the upcoming industrial action that is going to be happening on May the 5th, and how people, our listeners, can support this industrial action.
Thanks, Jacob. So we will be gathering with our members and supporters at Victorian Trades Hall, which I'm sure many of your listeners know where that is, but on the corner of Wygon and Russell Street. So we'll be there from about 10 a.m. We will be marching to Parliament. We're aiming to be at Parliament by around 11:30. We really encourage people to come along. If you can't come along, then please do send a message of support, to either on social media. There's heaps of residents' pages. I'm sure that, if you're on social media, there's lots of stuff. There's lots of chat about the bins in particular, a little bit about parking. I think just particularly some of the areas like Marybeck, we've had some real targeting of home care workers, which you wouldn't believe, trying to be docked for pay bans really heavily, and home maintenance workers. I think just showing a bit of solidarity for some of those workers that are some of the lowest paid, like if people can be really vocal about that. We've seen some of that, and I want to thank everyone who is doing that. Like, our members see that stuff, they often can't comment online, or their employers might go after them. So we are seeing that stuff, though, and just want to thank everyone who's doing that. But yeah, please rock up on the day if you can, and spread the word. We've got lots of stuff on our social media. Please get on there and share it around, and hopefully we've got a really good turnout on the day.
Word.
Well, yeah, thank you very much, Tash, for being on our program. And, yeah, all the solidarity to the council workers. And, yeah, we very much hope you secure a good agreement.
Yeah, can nice.
Really appreciate it. Thank you so much for being so generous with your time as well this morning.
Oh, no worries. Work on.
Thank you.
Thanks again. Okay, we're just speaking to Tash Walk, Secretary of the Australian Services Union. And yeah, just another plug to our listeners. The ASU council workers will be taking industrial action for 24 hours on May the 5th. And you can support their mass mobilisation by going to the Trades Hall at 10 a.m. I think it's going to be quite exciting. And I mean, it's also a good way to kind of kick off May. With May being May Day, and I just want to make another plug for our listeners to kind of to tune in to the special May Day program we have next Friday.
Word. And if you're north side, keep an eye out. There may be some sort of action at the next Hume Council meeting in Broadmeadows on Monday night in solidarity with ASU members there. So, yes, more strength to your arm, comrades.
Okay. I was thinking, I was actually just went, I was thinking maybe we could actually end the program with a bit of a. A song. So I thought we could actually, given our discussion about the Queensland kind of the issue, the kind of repression of free speech in Queensland.
We've got to play a bit of Farnsie.
We've got to definitely play Two Strong Hearts by John Farnham. And do you have any things you want to add about introducing this song?
Just that. It's always cool to see creative protest and people being clever. And, those Queensland comrades are doing a bloody great job. It's it warms the heart every time you see it. So here he is, John Farnham, Two Strong Hearts, and shout out to all the Palestine solidarity activists across Melbourne, across Australia, and up in Meanjin, Brisbane.
So tell me tenderly, I wanna give my life to you.
All right. That was Two Strong Hearts by John Farnham. But yeah, we don't have any time now. We're finished with the program. Like to thank all our listeners and thank our guests. And stay tuned for Left After Breakfast. You're listening to Green Left Radio on 3CR 855 AM.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.